Well, good evening, and I'd like to start by I'd like to start by thanking you for giving me this opportunity to share my thoughts on the science innovation strategy this evening. As we're all aware, this is a crucial time for science, engineering, and innovation in the UK. We're approaching a general election in which only the brave or the foolhardy will believe that they can predict the outcome. And we expect that to be followed by a challenging comprehensive spending review in which areas that were perceived to have received relative protection to date, including science and innovation, will come under close scrutiny. I'd therefore like to congratulate the Minister and his team for producing a strategy that sets the scene very well for the challenges ahead. Indeed, the very fact that we now have a single document that takes a long-term view across science, innovation, and skills, and is signed by both the Chancellor, the Business Secretary, and the Minister for Science, is a very encouraging development. The strategy recognises that further action will be required if the UK is to maximise its potential for research and innovation, and provides us with some helpful pointers about where we should focus our effort. More specifically, it highlights two reviews that are being undertaken to inform policy development in this area, one led by Paul Nurse, my counterpart at the Royal Society, who will be looking at research councils, and one that I will lead, addressing collaboration between businesses and academic researchers. And I'd like to spend a few minutes explaining what the focus of my review will be. It's fair to say that I'm not the first person to take an interest in business-university collaboration. There have been many eminent individuals who've grappled with this issue before me, as this slide shows. However, I've been asked to look at quite a specific question, which is fortunate, because the timescale for this review is rather tight. I'm due to produce a summary report shortly after the general election, and that's going to be an interesting challenge. My specific interest is in understanding how we can foster long-term strategic collaborations between academic researchers and companies that will deliver broad-based benefits to the UK. I've had a close involvement in the Research Excellence Framework through my role as chair of one of the main panels, and I actually found it a very encouraging experience. The REF scores for impact were very strong, actually higher than those for publications, and I was really impressed by many of the case studies that I saw from a whole range of disciplines. Collectively, these provide compelling evidence that the research conducted in our universities does indeed result in an enormous range of successful applications. Often those impacts are not planned and actually may be quite unexpected by those who conducted the original research, emphasising the importance of investing across a wide base of research activity. However, there are many examples of companies benefiting because they've planned to do work with academia. And it's perhaps no surprise that when you look at the impact case studies, certain companies, and it's notably those with structured, well-planned interactions with universities, those companies are cited over and over again. I'm interested in why some companies choose to adopt this approach, and also in why so many don't, and also in why some collaborations are so much more successful than others. My own experience at Cambridge University in establishing these types of long-term collaborations with industry has convinced me of one really critical success factor, and that is the development of trusting relationships that enable collaborating partners to have an open dialogue over a period of years. Without that, it's almost impossible to expect a company to share their long-term vision with the academics in the collaboration. And if they're not prepared to share that, there's a serious risk that the academics will end up trying to answer the wrong questions. My experience as a researcher has also shown me time and time again that understanding industry's long-term needs can be a very rich seam for it generating exciting, intellectually stimulating research questions. Every researcher sets out to answer a question, and it seems to me that in the UK we're perhaps missing out on opportunities for academics to be inspired by the questions derived from the needs of companies. And I'm not talking about near-term incremental product development needs, but questions inspired by an understanding of where a business wants to be in 5, 10, 20 years' time, and working out how an academic area of research can help companies get there. So together with my review team, and drawing very heavily on the work conducted by others on the topic of business-university collaboration, I'll be looking for gaps in current policies and provisions, opportunities to scale up successful approaches or transfer good practice from one sector or discipline to others, and innovative ideas for interventions that could make a real difference in our performance in this area. We'll also be looking at how recent policy developments have impacted on the landscape, for better or worse. And in particular, I've been asked to consider the impact of the UK's industrial strategy and how we can lever off developments here to promote business-university collaboration. Our review will look across all sectors, research disciplines, types and sizes of companies and universities, and across all regions in the UK. And we really very much welcome input from you here today. And I would encourage you to respond to the call for evidence. And you can see here some of the other ways of getting involved. We're particularly interested in hearing from those with first-hand experiences of these types of collaboration, whether positive or negative. So please come and speak to me or my Academy colleagues, Hayatin Sillon and Helen Yules, who are here this evening, if you can help. The second area of strategy that I'd like to talk about is that of the capital expenditure. The science and innovation strategy gave some clarification on plans to invest the £5.9 billion in science capital committed at Spending Review 13. The consultation on capital has shown strong support for using this money in rather low-key ways, providing well-found labs in the science base and equipment to support individual research grants won by peer review. So the government's to be commended that £13 billion is being reserved for such projects. However, there is a lack of clarity currently about what else is to be placed under this heading. We know from the strategy that it does, for example, include our international subscription to CERN, and we're concerned about how much more is expected to come out of that pot. The £2.9 billion is for high-profile Grand Challenge projects, as the Minister said. These are capital investments in new initiatives, and this raises concerns about who's going to pay for the running costs, those batteries. And the decision on resource funding to support these new initiatives has been delayed to this year's spending review. The integration of capital commitments with resource planning and skills development is vital. We can't fund capital in isolation and then expect the research councils to pick up the bill for the running costs of new initiatives out of their budgets, which have been decreasing in real terms. The third area of the strategy I would like to discuss this evening is skills. The Science and Innovation Strategy rightly highlights the key importance of nurturing scientific talent. The UK doesn't have the mineral wealth of other countries to draw on. Our future wealth and prosperity will be through advancing our scientific knowledge and adding value to goods and services through innovation. The report draws on the good work that the government is undertaking in this area, but does it go far enough? Well, firstly, we need to look at how serious the skill shortage is. Engineering UK reports in its 2015 annual digest that the UK needs to recruit an extra 1.82 billion people to work in engineering between 2012 and 2022. These people are predicted to contribute an extra £27 billion per annum to the UK economy. And as Engineering UK points out, that's equivalent to the cost of building 1,800 new schools or 110 new hospitals annually. So how close are we to achieving that goal? Not so good. Currently, we only recruit just over 100,000 engineers per annum, and that includes both technicians and graduates. So we need to nearly double the numbers going into engineering. The government uses a pipeline analogy to describe the supply of engineers. And I'm afraid our pipeline currently has many leaks. If we start with the GCSEs, where there are 600,000 per year. The Science and Innovation Strategy highlights the increases in individual sciences at GCSE level, which is really welcomed. And in 2014, 130,000 students sat physics, biology, and chemistry GCSEs. However, we still have the situation in the UK where only half of all those students achieved a grade C or above in mathematics and two sciences at GCSE. So that's down to 300,000 people each year, 300,000 people failing to achieve a basic level of mathematics and science required for progression to further education or employment in our sectors. In a single transition, the pipeline shrinks to half. Moving to post-16 education, in the last 10 years, the number of students taking mathematics at A-levels increased significantly, and we now have nearly 90,000 taking A-level maths each year. Biology and chemistry have also seen substantial increases in numbers, and that's all excellent. But the number of students taking A-level physics remains stubbornly low, currently just over 35,000. The issue of gender divide is also stubbornly persistent. Only one in five A-level physics students is female, a figure that's remained unchanged for 20 years despite significant efforts to address the problem. The plans in the strategy to train additional maths and physics teachers are welcome. The minister mentioned 17,500. But these are going to have to come from that same all small two pool of those that have studied A-level physics. Before I move on to discuss higher education, I would briefly like to turn to vocational education because the supply of technicians really are important. They underpin our research and innovation in universities and industries. The government is right highlighting opportunities for young people through vocational pathways, particularly through apprenticeships. And there's no doubt that apprenticeships are an excellent model of training for young people. And we in the science and engineering community have to support this route as being equal to the academic pathway and not an inferior option. Many young people now recognise the value of engineering apprenticeships. And for major companies like Rolls-Royce, BAE Systems and BT, competition for places is fierce, with thousands of applicants for only hundreds of places. The government and opposition parties are both keen to promote apprenticeships, and we ought to welcome this. However, when we look at the detail, it's clear that much of the growth in apprenticeships over the last 5 years has occurred in retail, in health and social care, and in business. And although overall the numbers in engineering look healthy, over half of these apprenticeships are at level two, which is equivalent to a GCSE. And last year, only 270 were high apprenticeships, HNCs, HNDs and above in engineering. And moreover, the number of apprenticeships is actually falling. So we therefore got to be very careful about creating unsatisfied demand from young people when promoting apprenticeships. Apprenticeships are jobs with training. They're the gift of employers, and employers need to feel sufficiently secure in the future and the economic outlook to make a decision to employ young people and put them on a training programme. Finally, I'd like to discuss issues affecting higher education. You can see here welcome rises across key STEM disciplines, and that's very, very welcome. However, many of our universities, particularly the pre-1992 universities, are now full to capacity, and there is, in general, little appetite for expansion. Laboratory-based subjects are expensive to deliver. They also require large amounts of space and infrastructure. HEFCE does provide additional support for high-cost subjects. For medicine and dentistry, Group A topics, universities receive an additional £9,800 per annum per full-time equivalent student. For Group B students, Group B subjects, which include science, engineering and technology, the additional support is under £1,500. This additional support is insufficient to cover the costs of teaching, consumables and equipment. Historically, universities subsidised science and engineering courses through other low-cost subjects. But now that students are paying their own fees themselves, their expectation, and quite rightly, is that the money that they pay will be spent on them and not used to support more expensive subjects. There's one final issue I should draw attention to in higher education, and that is that of immigration. When we look at engineering graduates over the last 10 years, it can be seen that non-UK students now represent a quarter of the cohort. And without the non-EU students paying full fees, many of these courses would be unsustainable. International students help universities balance their budgets. International students are also an important contributor to UK exports. The education sector contributes some £60 billion to the UK economy. The perception in the Indian subcontinent and the Far East is that through changes in our visa requirements and in rhetoric, the UK has raised barriers to overseas students, that they're less welcome, and also that it will be difficult for them to work in the UK after receiving their degrees. So what needs to be done? We need a systems approach to solving the skill shortages in the UK, addressing both enthusiasm for science and engineering and opportunities for education and training. We need a major programme to change the perceptions of engineering and science so that students and their influencers see that pursuing these subjects opens up a world of possibilities rather than putting them on a narrow pathway to a single destination. We need to ensure that the leaky pathway becomes a porous pipeline, bringing people into engineering at all stages of their career. This already happens to some extent. Graduates in maths, physics, and indeed business studies work as engineers. We need to celebrate and encourage this and encourage other routes into engineering to match where the jobs are where employees are needed. So I welcome the government's commitment to provide funding to HEFCE to work with the engineering profession to develop conversion courses for non-engineering graduates, and also that funding for master's courses with loans for the students could also contribute to this incoming flow. We do need to increase the supply of specialist teachers, not only in mathematics and physics, but also in computing and design and technology. And we need to increase employer engagement in the education system, supporting careers advice and providing real-life context to STEM so that young people can see these subjects brought to life. We need to work with small and medium-sized employers across science and engineering sectors to increase the number of apprenticeship opportunities. And we need greater investment in higher education to enable universities to expand provision in science and engineering. And finally, we need to tackle the issue of immigration to allow talented scientists and engineers to study and work in the UK. So, in summary, there's much to commend the Science and Innovation Strategy, and it represents a valuable step forward. But we in the science and engineering community and the government have still much work to enable the UK's research base, the innovation system and skills supply expand to achieve the scale and strength needed to deliver a prosperous and resilient future for the UK. Thank you.